The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, sometimes it's not a case of art imitating life, but rather life imitating art. So we had a man on the moon, which had been the stuff of science fiction for such a long time. And then there's talk of aliens. I'm joined by Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. The movie Alien, there is a new one.
There's a new one. Are you a fan of the Alien franchise?
Yeah,
I am. I thought it was fantastic. A new one called Romulus. And it's just come out, and it involves these explorers going into a vessel called Renaissance. It's a medical health facility. What do they find inside, Pat? The xenomorphs. The aliens are inside the vessel, you know.
Okay, so this is an abandoned earthly made facility.
That's right.
An
abandoned, and they go in to try to retrieve it, I suppose, and recycle it even. And then they discover the alien is inside, and it's another adventure, a kind of a haunted house type thing. But it's supposed to be great. I haven't seen it yet, but okay. I can't wait to see it.
Now, when you look at the possibility of there being life on anything that's reachable, we thought that it might be remote because you need certain building blocks, and now they might be present on Mars.
Well, that's the big news the last couple of weeks, Pat. There's more evidence now, not quite life, but certainly the signature of what might be life on Mars. They found in rocks on Mars a thing called hematite. Now, as a biochemist, Pat, hematite's interesting. It's a way to get energy. And if you see hematite in a rock on Earth, it means bacteria were in that rock. And now they've found hematite. It's an iron phosphate compound on this rock sample in Mars. That's the first thing they've found. They're very excited about a source of energy. And in the same rock, Pat, they've got these carbon organic chemicals. And of course, carbon is the basis for all of life. So you've ticked kind of two boxes there. And the third big box is water.
Yeah.
And they've just announced a massive amount of liquid water, maybe 10 kilometers below the surface, so it's deep below the crust on Mars. So the three key ingredients for life are there: water, carbon compounds, and now an energy source.
So it's possible that there could be life there, or there might have been life there before.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be people like us or chimpanzees.
No, not yet. No, that's right. We'd hear that in the news, that one, you know. But the biochemists, they're called astrobiologists, by the way. It's a subspecialty in biochemistry, are very excited because now you're all the boxes are being ticked in a sense. Now, you're right, it could have been life was there and it became extinct and it's a remnant of the former life that was on Mars. Or the conditions are there such that life may emerge in the future, shall we say. You never know.
And they roll over the hill in one of their Martian rovers and find the equivalent of the Statue of Liberty sticking
exactly.
up out of the sand.
Exactly. Our London double-decker bus. Wasn't that the one that was found? But it's causing big excitement. The water is especially good. There's an ocean of water there, or liquid water, which wasn't known before. It amazes me. You wouldn't think they would have seen this. But it's so deep in the crust. There was a seismometer was used to measure earthquakes on Mars in this particular thing called Perseverance. Or the InSight lander, rather. And that was picking up these earthquakes and knew it was moving through water because I could tell by the way the earthquake was moving that it must have been moving through. That was the evidence that there's water on Mars.
So to get at that water, very difficult if it's so far down.
Well, they flagged off Elon Musk here because if he wants to go to Mars, remember, and he wants water, to drill 10 to 20 kilometres down below the surface would be a bit tricky. So they're saying his aspirations might be a bit more challenged by that.
Now, if we look at the Milky Way, if we look at our solar system and what the likelihood of extraterrestrial life is, I mean, what would the statisticians say?
Yeah, it's hard to predict, of course, because it's either there is or there isn't. The statisticians are saying it's definitely there or it might not be there. That's not very helpful, is it?
No.
The evidence would be there's so many planets now in what's called the Goldilocks zone going around stars. Now, the Goldilocks zone means not too hot and not too cold. There are planets now. They can see these planets, incredibly.
This is why we've data centres in Ireland, by the way. We're in the Goldilocks zone
for them. Yeah. Right, yeah. So they've seen these. There could be billions of these planets, by the way, that are in the right kind of zone for life. So it becomes a probability thing. In other words, the chemicals and the water and all that, there's a chance of them being on one of these planets. So the chance of life being on one of these planets has gone up a lot simply because we can now see these planets and we know they're in the right kind of condition. Obviously, if it's too hot, life will boil off. If it's too cold, it'll freeze. So clearly now they think there are lots of, maybe as many as billions of planets, by the way, that are a bit like Earth going around a sun.
Now, the question would be, at what point in their evolution are they? Because life on Earth was very primitive at the beginning, and how it survived in extreme situations, you know, some of the bacteria and so on, how did they survive? So we could be looking at those, and those guys can't come to visit us.
No.
Not for millions of years.
This is the central problem. They may have been there and they became extinct, you know?
Yeah.
Or we may become extinct before they reach us, this kind of thing. So the vastness of space gets me, Pat, and how much distance there is and all those sorts of questions come up as well.
Now, artificial intelligence, about which we speak regularly, may have a role to play in determining whether there's something out there.
That's the second. All this week, amazingly, there was the movie, and now there's all this. So the thing called SETI, which is a search for extraterrestrial intelligence in America, they've been running this for years, and they're trying to pick up radio waves from space. Because if you pick up radio, that means there's probably some intelligent life out there. But it's very difficult trying to scan, you know, the sky for radio waves. And AI is now being brought to bear. And the latest one is incredible. This AI system can now analyze 2 terabytes of data per second. Now, that's an amazing amount of data is being taken from the universe, as it were, and it's being analysed for radio waves. It's gone, in other words, our capacity to analyse these radio waves has gone up massively recently.
So our scanning of the skies will be much more comprehensive
and
rapid.
Exactly, yes. And they're predicting now, and the bandwidth is wider. They were using a tiny bandwidth for a while. You know, now it's a much bigger bandwidth, and all this information is being taken in. And of course, the AI is trying to look for little anomalies.
But, I mean, we're governed by the speed of light. So the radio waves, which will travel at that speed, will reach us. But how far away are they?
Well, it could be too far away. But can you imagine, Pat, if we pick up radio waves from 1 billion kilometres away? Now, what would it sound like? Would it be music? Or what, who knows? This kind of thing, they're wondering. And what gets me is it'll be useful on Earth, this. Because if you can analyse 2 terabytes per second of data. Now, remember, your average laptop has 1 terabyte in total in it.
Yeah.
And this can analyse 2 terabytes per second. It's a massive amount of data can be assessed. That could be used on Earth. And as you know, one justification for space exploration
is
spin-offs. We wouldn't have computers today without the Apollo program, for instance. You know? So in other words, they're using this AI system now in this way, and it could be used on Earth in all kinds of ways. That's a really good part
of it. But when you plug in your AI machine, how much energy does it use?
Well, that's the next problem, isn't it? A huge amount of energy to be used with these things. Hence, we need better sources of energy, I guess.
Now, you may have seen that report today about heat-related deaths are likely to increase significantly in Ireland over the coming decades, and also deaths from the cold. This is, I think, in The Lancet.
Yep.
What do you make of it?
It's important, this part, actually. I did a piece on this in the Sunday Independent, to be honest, last weekend, before this came out. So a bit ahead of the curve on it.
Yeah.
This Lancet Public Health Journal, a very important journal, is predicting a lot more deaths because of heat, even in Ireland. This is what's, they've looked at lots of 30 countries were looked at. At the moment, there's 30 deaths per year in Ireland because of heat. It's not very many, is it? But still, it's 30 people dying because of heat. That will go up a lot. They reckon by 2100, more than tenfold increase, 563. Deaths, but it's not just deaths. Hot weather increases risk of all kinds of illnesses and makes illnesses worse, like heart disease and so on. So it isn't just about death. So because of global warming, they're predicting all over Europe now there will be an increase in basically ill health and ultimately death. Yeah. So it's quite
when
serious.
You're talking about ambient temperatures in summers, which are actually higher than the core body temperature, that leads
huge
to
pressure.
Massive.
Oh, well, I hate that. Do you hate that? And I'm in a country where it's over 37. I really feel the strain.
Because
you can't, your body is fighting against this extra temperature, you know, and that puts massive strain on your body. And sadly, some get heat stroke and can die, you know. So it's a very important piece. It's recommending, by the way, Pat, things like housing has to improve. Because housing that's pretty bad will heat up in the daytime, you know. And it's called hot house syndrome, actually. If the housing is better and you're better ventilation or thicker walls, that will maintain the temperature inside a house.
It's funny, when you go to Mediterranean countries, particularly in the south, you know, you look at Scandinavia and they've got loads of insulation and maybe big glass windows so you can look at the glaciers. In the south, in the traditional housing, small windows, verandas.
Yeah, they knew what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing.
Thick walls was really important.
Yeah.
Because that means the house doesn't heat up. It's like a thermos flask in a way, which can keep things cold or hot, remember. So the houses are like thermos flasks and they maintain a lower temperature. So the future of housing is an important aspect of this, I think.
So in the winter then, when you heat your house,
you get the same benefit. It's like a flask. Flasks keep things hot or cold, remember. So if you've got insulation, you can keep a house warm in the winter and cold in summer.
The planners ever kind of pay attention to stuff like this in The Lancet?
It's very hard. Now, the UK study, Pat, last week, 4.5 million people apparently last year were affected by the heat because their houses were too hot. A lot of people. Now, they weren't dying, but they were suffering, you know, because of their ailments, various ailments. So it's an important question to keep considering. But they should think about this, shouldn't they? With global warming, it should be a feature.
Absolutely. Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry and much else at Trinity College Dublin. Thank you very much
thank you,
for
Pat.
Joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.